Hello and welcome everyone to next episode of Threadside. Now we are discussing events from June this year, and we have amazing guest, a guy that you cannot not like. Like, he's the very definition of being adorable and amazing person, Flint. Hello, Flint. How are you?
Yeah, hello. I'm doing very fine, and thank you very much for the introduction. My image is very adorable of a little rock. Maybe I'm also in person. We'll see. But yes, very happy to be here.
We super great to have you on. As I said before we started recording, mm-hmm. I really, really love reading everything that you post, and I think that like everyone loves that. You are like, first of all, very productive, and you are an amazing person. So, I don't know if anyone in the space already doesn't know about you, but if there was someone that doesn't know you, can you please describe yourself?
Yeah, sure. Let me give me a bit of a background. So I'm Flint. I hail from continental West Europe. I'm married, 2 children, soon to be 3. I just left my 30s, and now I have the big 4 on my name. From age, which was a sobering event. So a bit of my background history for those who don't know. I spent my 20s basically at university. I had a voracious appetite for learning, so I got degrees in history, political science, and education, with also studies in international economics, European law, and management, which was really fun. But then when I went into the job market, I realized I didn't actually have any skills to earn money. I mean, it's very nice to discuss the economic implications of the Mamelukian economy on the Venetian trade negotiations, but nobody pays you money for that. So my only options were either be a history teacher or be a bank teller. And I mean, those are fine jobs, but they're jobs like you have basically the same salary for your entire life. And that's not something I wanted. I wanted, financial independence, freedom to take care of my loved ones and to live an exceptional life. And I couldn't do that. So I said, well, shit, what now? So I spent the next 6 years basically trying different careers, different industries, different countries, just to find an avenue, a path that would allow me to develop myself and build me the life that I was dreaming about. So in short, well, first I tried history teacher and bank teller, didn't like it. Then I became an EU lobbyist, basically defending the interests of industry and renewable energy, nuclear energy, coal energy, and some very shady other stuff. Then I became a debt collector, B2C. So if you didn't pay your bills, hello, this is Flint, please pay, or you don't have any electricity anymore, which was interesting. Then I went to France and I became a payment negotiator, B2B, so basically negotiating between large industrial companies about their payment conditions, so forth and so on. I learned a lot about communications, but again, in a corporate environment, your income is basically fixed. You can basically beg to your manager for a 2% increase, but that's about it. So it's like, look, I learned a lot, but I'm stuck. So I decided to start my own translation company because I'm fairly good in languages. Which I did for about a year, but I thought, well, I can't really scale this beyond myself. So this is not the way. So I joined a startup which was selling second-hand cars over the internet, with the basic idea that most people, when they buy a second-hand car, they get swindled because they don't know anything about cars. So they were selling, look, we find a car for you. We send an expert to make sure that the car is in proper condition. You pay the car, give us a piece, and everybody's happy. I did it also for about a year. It was a very good experience, but I wasn't really good at it. I mean, it wasn't bad, but mediocre. So I was like, look, sales is good. Sales is a good avenue because, your productivity is directly related to your income. But maybe cars isn't for me because I don't really care about cars. So I thought, well, I like IT, so let's do IT. So I moved to Ireland and I joined IBM as a cybersecurity sales. Because they needed somebody who spoke 3 languages, and I am trilingual, so that's a good benefit for me. Mm-hmm. Spent a year there, learned a lot about IT, a lot of sales, and I realized I don't have the talent. You could become one of the elites, because if you know, Ireland is basically the mecca of sales of Europe, because they have very low corporate taxes, So the biggest and the best salesmen of Europe are all living there. And when I met them, I was like, look, I don't know if it's talent or something else in the water, but I don't have what they have. So I'm never going to be able to earn $500,000 or $1 million a year in sales. It's not just not going to happen. So I was like, what can I do? So like IT sales, cybersecurity sales. Okay, why not IT? So I said, spent some time looking up the options, and then I moved back to my home country, did a boot camp, and then used my connections to get back at IBM in IT. Spent 2 years there learning how to program because I didn't know anything. Then I went into the cloud because it was like the hot, new, cool thing. And then I went freelance, started my own cloud consulting company. And I was basically renting myself as a consultant to different companies. Was making pretty good money, like 15K a month. And then I was at a concert of Andrea Bocelli with my wife when I found See Me Sales blog post. Like, mm-hmm. I made $1 million in a year. I was like, yes. That sounds good. That's actually what I need to do. It's like, if he can do it, so can I. I spent a number of months learning Solidity. And then it was of June of last year, right before DSS, I earned my first dollar, literally from a Sherlock contest, $1. So I said, well, this is working. I quit my job and I went all in. Not because...
dollar is suffice for like... yeah, 50 minutes of my life.
Exactly,
it's already paying off.
Yeah, it'll be, I have a family to feed, bills to pay, $1, that's enough. No, but my calculation was, if you look at... audio is still working?
Yeah, it's working, yeah.
Oh, my God. So if you look at history, when people make money, if you look at the 19th century United States, like oil tycoons like Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, or post-war Korea, Samsung or Toyota, or the dot-com people from 2000, it's always at a certain period, certain waves, when with the same amount of effort, you can make 10 times, 100 times more money. And with crypto, it's basically the same. You have like waves when the cycles go up. And if you're in the sector at the right moment, then you can go to the moon, as the meme says. But if you just start learning when the wave is already there, then you're too late. So my calculation was, look, we know that there's going to be a bull market, normally next year, maybe the year after. If I start learning now full time, I should be in time to build my own little boat. And if the 100K BTC comes along, then I'm in time to hit the wave. So even if I knew that for the next 6 months, I would be in the red on a monthly basis, unless I got really lucky, I said, look, this is worth it. I mean, the risk reward is worth it. And if everything fails, you know, I can always go back to making 15K a month. So it's not like I'm risking my life savings. Mm-hmm. So, I went in July full time. First 6 months were pretty hard. Well, July, August, I made good money. And then it was basically crypto winter, like no contests. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing now? I tried Immunify a bit, but it was like bounty hunting. So I'm just starting auditing, like bounty hunting. What is this? Which is another, I mean, at the time, I thought this is an entirely other field of expertise. So I don't really know what's going on, what to do. So then from end of December until June of this year, basically full-time auditing. Made good progress, made some good money, but in the end, like, not enough to really justify it. And, you know, the bull market, like, is it coming next month? Then my wife got pregnant. And I was like, look, my savings are kind of going down. I can't really continue risking this. And just by chance, one of the leading Web2 cybersecurity firms of my country found me. It's like, look, hey, we need somebody in the cloud security. Are you interested? I said, like, well, okay, cool. I can go to cybersecurity. So I said, yes, well, why not? It's a fairly good salary. That was like also freelance, 12K a month. So that's what I'm doing now. So that's basically my story and where I came. And on Twitter, I'm often active because I thought from the beginning, let's just document what I'm doing. Because I see very often people like, look, I'm making 20K, I'm making 50K, I'm making 100K. And it's like, how? It's like, let's just document like day, how did this work? And look, I mean, maybe I'm missing some magic pills or magic whatever, but this is a lot that is very difficult. And I had so many people comment me, like message me, like, we're so happy you're doing this. Like, it's actually a real person going on a real journey on how it goes from zero. Not like, yes, I flipped a cup and now I have a million. Like, yeah, that's not realistic. Or people, I mean, maybe people exist like that. I mean, you have like Obront and Dead Rosie, who apparently did that. That's great, but I just wanted to show a more real path of somebody who's starting from zero and is just struggling every day to to advance. And you know, you're gonna go upwards in life, but it's often a lot of up and down before you get there. So, so in a nutshell, that's me.
Yeah. No one expected such broad introduction, but you basically did it all. You did everything that was possible on the market, basically.
Yeah, because I was like, what do I need to do? Because it's not like today I have a lot more information, but like about 10 years ago, it's like, what do you do? Like IT? Yeah, but you know, you need to go back to school. You have four more years. I already spent 10 years in university. Mm. So what am I going to do? Like I have a sales communication. Yeah, I mean, that's possible. So, but yeah, it was like a long period of just searching everything, going left and right. And you know, so many often at some points I was like, this is a failure. But at the same time, I also learned a lot of skills, which helped me go further. I mean, my sales career failed, but at the same time, it also meant that the moment I started IT with like a bootcamp of 4 months, I could start at IBM, which is normally not possible, you know, because you need to do like 20 interviews of lead code. I didn't do one lead code in my life. It was like, hey, I have a certificate. You know, you like me. You know, put in a word, please. And then, yes, okay, cool. You can come back. So yes.
Here you go, my lovely. Just
yeah, but I mean, you need to leverage what you have. Huh? And then afterwards, when I started my own cloud company, the fact that I came from IBM was basically for most companies and clients, like, look, IBM, you know, you have to be good because it's IBM. So yes, I am flawless. And then, I mean, so yeah.
Yeah,
you do what you can and you go forward.
Concerning this, what you said last, IBM. I know that in Poland, for example, Google pays really low, comparing to other companies. But it's Google, and if you are like work in Google for 2 years, like everyone wants you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's similar, as you said, in IBM.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how it works in most of West Europe. Basically, if you're an employee, yeah, you get paid relatively well. But if, for example, if you get paid 3K before taxes, in actuality, the company is paying like 10 or 12K because there's also all the social taxes and all extra taxes and whatsoever, like an infinite amount of taxes, which they pay you. So you get 3K before taxes, which is like 2K after taxes.
Okay.
But if you go as a freelance, like you have your company, then it's basically just an invoice and they don't have to pay any taxes. So they can pay you the full 12K. And then, I mean, you have to pay taxes on that, of course, with a good accountant. But that's like, yeah, four times the more money for yourself and you cost the same for the company.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I hear you. I also have my own company right now. So I know what's the difference, and like I would never go, you know, work to be hired by someone because just like you are putting invoice and you get like 100% of what they give you, but for you it's way way bigger amount of money. Especially as I said, if you have a good accountant, then like you won't pay as much taxes as you would normally.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but this is super cool. I you know, there is so many questions I want to ask you right now. Yeah, so
go ahead.
Yeah.
Go
so
ahead.
You said that now you are working full time in one of the companies, doing like cybersecurity, but not web security. So, how much time do you spend now weekly on web security?
Well, for the moment, it's fairly limited, also because my wife is 9 months pregnant. So I basically also have to do an entire household because. She spends most of her time sleeping, so.
But
normally 10, 20 hours, basically. I mean, I've just started to be precise, so I'm a senior cybersecurity engineer, and they just threw me like 7-8 clients, and it's mostly cloud related, so fixed up their AWS or Azure environment, implement information protection policies, give training on how not to be stupid and click on phishing emails. Some specific, also for laptops from the army for missile launching for Ukraine. I have to check that they can't be hacked. So it's very interesting, very varied, but because it's also very new, I do have to, invest a lot of time. Because as you know, when you do start a new thing, new job, a new contract, in the beginning, it's a lot of work just to get up and running. And after some time, it's like, okay, I know how to do this. I don't need to check it anymore. So then I'm hoping that I can do my normal job in like 30 hours, and then I can go back to just putting 30 hours in Web3. So
yeah, but still, as you said, 10, 20 hours is already really really big amount of time. Like, given that you have family, right? You have your normal job. Like, many people that I spoke with that have similar situation, they have family, they have kids, they have their day job, they're just spending like 5 hours, and like they cannot do more. Like, they say that they cannot do more. And like, how do you manage that? Because I remember I saw one tweet of yours that you said that you are working 40 hours on Web2, 30 hours auditing, 10 hours writing, 10 hours training. You have 2 children and a wife that is 9 months in and soon will give you a third child. So how? Yes. How?
Well, I can say that I'm just superhuman and that you just have to grind it and blah, blah, blah. But to be honest, it's extraordinarily difficult. It's really difficult. Every day you wake up and there's a pressure on your head. Like, I need to do this. I have an entire list of 5 to 10 things I have to do. So I'm sprinting the moment I wake up, basically. And yes, because I have small children, you can't really plan like a machine. Because the small children, when they come to daddy, you have to be there as a father. So, my baby boy doesn't want to sleep. Well, then I'm not sleeping. So it's very difficult. But basically, I cut out everything aside from work, family, and gym. So no more hobbies, no more entertainment, no more anything. Okay. So I usually get up at 5 o'clock. Just get a cold shower, get a gallon of coffee. I work 2 hours, usually writing, or I'm trying to keep up to date with hacks and stuff like that. Then children wake up, help them to get dressed, breakfast, bring them to school, go back. Then from 8 till 12, Web2 job. Then bit of a break, take a little nap if I can. And 13 to 16 again, then get my children back. 16 to 17, finish up Web2. 17 to 18, play with children and help with making dinner. 18 to 19, food. 19 to 21, work on Web3. 21, 22, take my boy and make him sleep, because he only wants to sleep in my arms. And then 22, get to bed. And then I forgot, like 5 to 6 times a week, I go to the gym running or training with a personal trainer. So just what I'm saying, it sounds utterly insane. It is. And, I'm not going to say I do this every day perfectly, but I strive to do it every day. Because basically, if you want to have an exceptional life, you need to do exceptional things or, insane life, insane things. And work-life balance, there is no balance. There is no balance at all. But, it's a choice you make. I can just sit on my ass and make 12K a month working 40 hours. And then I'm earning more than 1% of the population, pretty sure. But I want more. And if I want more, I have to do more. And, there's no magic shortcut. There's nothing I have found. And when I look at people who do a lot better, very often they're like 21, 22, they still live with their parents and they can literally work 16 hours a day. I can't do that. So I'm not going to be as fast or as quick as those people. But as long as I continue and I simply don't give up, I'm also going to get there, I believe. So,
Okay. But what about burnouts? Do you experience them?
Basically, yeah. Well, Not mentally, but every few months, my immune system says, fuck you, and I have to.
So, yeah. I have enough of you.
Yeah, basically, because, you do accumulate fatigue, and you know, off every often you grind your teeth and you work through it. But at a certain point, and I've learned to manage this, like, I sense, like, my body is starting to get sick. So I have to take a day off and just drink some, ginger tea with honey and just, watch the clouds, which is really frustrating. Because otherwise, I'm just going to fall sick. Not mentally, I have to say, no. Mentally, no. But physically, yeah, you have limits of your body and, you have to respect them because otherwise it's just not going to work.
Okay. Do you have any special protocol that you train your discipline on, or this is natural for you?
Well, that's a very good question, because discipline is one of the most important things in your life if you want to achieve great goals like that. And to be honest, the discipline I have, or willpower, if you might call it like that, is simply something you build over a very long period of time. You know, I didn't have a lot of willpower when I left university, but when I was forced to be a debt collector, because I had to pay my bills and I had to make 200 calls a day to people who are threatening to kill me, to mothers who just lost their children to cancer, to stuff like that, the entire day, you do build willpower because you have no other choice. And when you do three or five or six different careers and different industries, and they all fail, and every time you're sitting there, like, I'm so much older than the other people. I know so many young people who achieved so much more. And then the frustration and all that stuff, yeah, that builds character. Mm. Not as a goal, but simply, if you get hit a lot in the face at a certain point, your face gets stronger. So, yeah, so for the moment, no, I don't really have a lot of problems with willpower because, I spent a decade training it.
In your case, it's like you experience so many things that were, like, I guess, hard experiences, as you said, being this debt collector and experiencing all this kind of situation that you experience, where you don't want to be. Like, and on the other hand, you see where you want to be and, like, you want not to be in similar situation again so bad that it's natural. Can you say it like that?
No, not really. It's basically what do you define as hard? What is difficult? Huh? If something is extremely difficult for you, it will be hard to do. But that's based on your experience. Mm-hmm. So when my experience of a hard time is literally, I have a woman on the phone. Yes, I just came back from a funeral for my little boy who died of cancer. Mm-hmm. And I have to talk to her to get an agreement. Otherwise, she's going to have to mourn with candlelight. That's difficult. That's really difficult. And then you have to close the telephone, take up, and then somebody is threatening to kill me. That's really hard. And when you've done something like that, anything else is this difficult? Well, in comparison, no. Oh my God, I have to stare at a screen for 40 hours and type and code. Oh my God. Yeah, it's doesn't really register as hard just because I've done other things which were so excruciatingly difficult. So it's just about that. I mean, my only limitation is the hours I can work and my physical health and, of course, my family, which I have to take care of. But in the end, it's simply, look, this is so much easier than what I've done. So mentally, I don't have a problem.
Okay. And, like, given that you have very limited time for Web3 right now, how do you handle that? What do you prioritize right now to get the most of it?
Yes, for the moment, I'm feeling very frustrated because I don't really have time for contests. In August, I had a group of people, Team Rock Solid, which we did a few contests. But now, with the new job and with the baby on the way, I can't really invest time in contests, so I'm basically learning, writing, I'm working on a website to launch my own company, auditing company. So it's frustrating for the moment, but yeah, it's mostly preparing, reading, writing, and hopefully from November, I can really restart contests and start doing business development to get clients for private audits.
Amazing. What is your biggest achievement? Something that you are most proud of in Web3?
Most proud of Web3. That's difficult, to be quite honest. Because, you know, when you start, you're like, yes, this is so awesome that I did this. And 2 months later, it was like, this is just so basic. how couldn't I see this? What was memorable for me, maybe a better way to say this, was, for example, my first contest I did for Kanto. I did it together with someone else, and we got 4K. It was like, wow. And basically, we got it for a documentation. Like, the nut spec was wrong, and it was the only bug, and it was like, for this we got 4K. How is this possible? This is so great. And then we had another one, for example, in the ETH Credit Guild in December. I worked my ass off. I got 14 submissions, and I got like 20 euros. And I was in the other sense like, oh my God, this is so difficult, so painful. For example, one I was very proud of was a few months ago. Can't go specific because it's private, but there was one bug where I found that in a specific use case for a specific chain, the protocol would assume the protocol, the contract would assume that the protocol was in a different state, and as a result would call, would make a call 4 to 5 times extra without any need. Which would basically make every transaction, depending on the price, increase with one euro. Mm-hmm. Which, if you have a like high volume AMM, is very damaging. Mm-hmm. If it's a small one, then low. So I didn't get paid for that because protocol said nice find, we're gonna fix it. But yeah, the impact was gas, so it wasn't accepted. But it was really nice that it was really very unique and was accepted, and they're going to fix it, and it's a huge protocol. So I was like, still recognition. Look, I can do this. Yeah, I do have the skills. Not the money, maybe, but the skills are there. So
okay. And how do you approach to learning? Because like there are so much different approaches that people have and are like praising that. Mm. What personally works for you best?
I think I basically follow the approach from C. Michelle, mm-hmm. which she described a long time ago. It's basically first you can start either by the documentation or by the code. Doesn't really make a difference, I believe. But first you go like high level, that you understand architecturally how do the pieces work together. Mm-hmm. So you could either do it with like Excalibur, you draw it out, we make it on paper. But you need to understand how the pieces fit mm-hmm. together. And once you have that, then I start like line by line. Okay, what does this? Because very often a contract is all about state management. Mm-hmm. All the state changes, have they all been explored? Are they all documented? Are they all foreseen? Or are there unforeseen consequences? So basically go line by line. And each time, reflect on your mental image, make it more detailed, increase the level. The relief, so you have a better understanding. Make notes, and at the end of the detailed pass through, normally I have like 20 or 30 notes. Mm-hmm. Then you go through all these, like, is this really something or is this not? Once you have done all that and I can't find anything else, then I usually go to like checklists, or solidits to see like are there very unique stuff that is maybe applicable to this protocol that mm-hmm. I'm just not aware of. So that's basically it. So go high level, lower, 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 which is basically a common approach, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, like mostly like Dead Roses says that he's just doing like midline and he doesn't care.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, some people are shy. You know, yeah. You know, it's like,
Yeah, like, you know, I personally had 20-step formula that I never stick to, but in the end, like, never worked. Mm-hmm. Never worked.
No. Well, it's basically about understanding. You know, you just need to understand the protocol at a deep enough level that you can make it work in your head. And you can understand every interaction and every state change. How you get there, you know, you can go from A to Z, from Z to A, jump in the middle, do a dance, however you want to. But you just need to understand everything perfectly or as perfectly
as possible. This is well said. That this is like the core of it, and it doesn't matter how you approach it. It was like, I think that Nikola Tesla had this, that he built all his machines in his head, and he said that building prototype is just a waste of resources. So yeah, building this mental model, so yeah, that you know the problem so good that you can like go through all the possible cases in your head, like
or just like that. If you have a case, like, can this work? That, I mean, basically you can visualize it before your eyes, like, look, this is going to go, this, so this should be the outcomes. And then, of course, you check. It's not like, I mean, you do have to test stuff. But yeah, basically that.
Yeah, definitely. Moving on, like, recently there is the bigger phenomenon that is happening, the conditional pots. What do you think about them? Do you think about, like, recently I think it was Euler V2 that had like over a million pot, but like there was no med and highs, and many people like were sure that their funding was either med or high, and they didn't get paid and were really upset. As an introduction to this topic, what is your take on that?
Well, I think it's not really a... It's mostly marketing, just to create a hype. Look at the big numbers, but very often when there's so much money involved, the protocol is incentivized to fight against the auditors. You had, for example, it was a Uniswap foundation on C4. Wasn't a big pot, was a lot smaller, but you basically had for weeks and weeks auditors and the Uniswap fighting against each other, Uniswap finding any reason whatsoever to disqualify. And yeah, that's not a good situation, because auditors start resenting the protocol. It's like, look, why on earth should I start on this when it's so clear that they're going to invent new rules or whatever just to not pay me? So I don't think it's a good system. If they really want to spend the money on the security, then they don't need to make it conditional. Conditional I don't like it. I don't think it is a good way to interact with auditors. And when you see, for example, the new Uniswap contest that's going to happen, I've seen so many threads on Twitter look what happened in the past. Those people are not going to pay out. It's going to be an issue. I mean, it makes me think of like Sherlock escalations, when you have a finding and then you have like 50 people trying to find any reason to disqualify it, and then you spend weeks or months just arguing with people over the validity or impact of the finding, when you just want to find bugs. So it's not, I don't.
Yeah, like similarly, you know, concerning these escalations, I saw on C4, like it was, I had this period of time when I didn't do C4, and then I like came back to it. And I was shocked finding, like, before it was like, if judge found your issue like to be not an issue, then you just, you know, made your point and either he accepted that or not. But right now, what is happening, like, people are actually doing battle royale in the comment section under basically any issue that is accepted by the judge. And yeah, like, for me personally, I really hate that. I don't know about you. I hate to, you know, fight with others. But, like, if people are attacking me, I'm attacking them as well. But I really don't like to be in this situation. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I hate it. I mean, it's basically the reason why I'm not competing on Sherlock anymore. Because, I mean, there it's designed to have a battle royale every time. Because, and this is also the nature of contests, if you win, I lose. If you have a unique medium and I have a high with 5 duplicates, if you get invalidated, I, for example, get $10,000. If you get validated, I get $500. So I have a very strong economic incentive to undermine your finding in any way possible. And I mean, and some people think like, look, people are going to be a good nature in this and that, and the truth will come out. I think a more realistic approach is people are going to think with their money and with their potential revenue. And you can see this in Sherlock and also more and more on C4, that they're just trying to fight it and just trying to bully the other people until they simply go hands in the air from exhaustion and just give up and say, screw this. Huh? And especially with Sherlock, because, I mean, C4, you actually, the judges are, I mean, known experts. Huh? If you have Picordus or Trust and you're trying to argue against them, well, especially Trust, you're going to get a very short and to the point response because you know they're better. But on Sherlock, for example, now you have like the community judging. You have people who don't really have a lot of expertise. And you had the last maker escalation where you had like 20 people who clearly are more experienced than the judge himself making arguments about the validity and invalidity. And nothing against the dude, the judge, huh? But I mean, you can't make this, you can't do this. If I have to judge between an opinion between Trust and Obrand, I'm sorry, I'm not qualified. I mean, so it's a very bad system because also, I think yesterday Sherlock announced they're going to stop doing escalations. So maybe all my tweets and articles were finally heard. But yeah, no, I think what I like is the system of Code Hogs. They have escalations, but it's private with the judge. If you don't like, you don't agree with the judge, you can argue against him. Look, this is why I believe it's valid, this way I believe it's valid. And then the judge can say yes or no, period. You don't see the other people's findings. You can't invalidate or invalidate their findings. So the judge decides. And yes, if you have a crappy judge, that's problematic. But assuming you have a good judge, then it's fair for everybody. But the global PvP is just a bad system and an exhausting system.
Yeah, I guess exhausting for everyone. Do you have any expectations, you know, what the new formula for Sherlock might be?
I don't know, because, I mean, it's because there's also, see, for example, another big news is that Code for Arena got bought by Zelic. And when I read the post from SOC, it's clear that the margins for a platform like this are very slim. And it's, I mean, when they say they need more funding, that means their burn rate is too high, so they're losing money. So clearly, it's a difficult question. Because in Sherlock, with their community judging, I mean, yes, the quality of judging isn't fantastic, but it's also very cheap. Because they pay like, one-fourth of a judge on Sherlock, on C4. So maybe they don't have the money to pay an actual expert. So in that case, I don't know what they're going to do. Because they have to pay their senior Watsons a lot, because that's the main advantage of Sherlock, that you have a guaranteed expert if you go there. So I don't know. Maybe they make the Watsons judge. Or they just say, screw escalations. This is a judge. His judgment is final, and good luck with it. Or they become just make it that you can only escalate your own finding, which would already help a lot.
Yeah, we'll see. And like we already discussed a bit, Code Hogs, Code Arena, and Sherlock, but still there is another big players on the field. We have Hats Finance and we have Cantina. Yeah. In your own opinion, you know, for anyone who maybe doesn't know how Hats works and Cantina works, the difference between...
Oh, okay, of course. Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, Hats is a very specific platform because they believe in speed. It's basically a sprint to find the bug first. So if the contest starts at 8 o'clock and you got a bug at 8:01, you win. Everybody person afterwards gets zero. So that's... It's personally not something for me. I don't want to work with that pressure because I want to take my time to really understand the protocol and then find bugs. And I mean, yeah, even if you submit to it, is it going to be valid? Is it going to be invalid? How many duplicates are there? There's so many uncertainty. I don't really want to add the extra uncertainty, am I first or not? But you know, some people really love it and they make a lot of money there. Also because a lot of people, I think, don't want the extra stress. There aren't that many auditors who pick hats. So from a game theory point of view, it could be a good option. If you like speed, if you like racing, yeah, it could be a good. Cantina, yeah, that's basically from Spearbit, huh? That's their platform. So I haven't really done a contest there. From what I hear, it's basically similar to C4. The only big difference is if you do really good on Cantina, I mean, the gates of Spearbit will open and you can get in there. Like recently, Zigtor was picked up. And yeah, I mean, for any auditor in the field, I mean, Spearbit is basically the Valhalla of auditing. So the fact that if you do good on Cantina, you have an opportunity to go get in there, that's that could be a good bonus. So, but they're pretty strict on judging, you know, from what I hear.
Yeah, like I did Cantina, like one contest. Like, no, two contests. One I won't mention because we didn't participate that. Okay, yeah, I can mention that. We did Euler. Wanted to do Euler with Merkel Bonsai. Me, Sorian, Merkel Bonsai. Unfortunately, like, we had, like, I think one or two meds were rejected. We did Blast and, like, we did pretty well on Blast. But like the biggest difference between Cantina and C4 is that first of all you have many judges. There is no single judge, and sometimes we had a situation where, like on Blast, for example, all our issues were rejected. But then we found that other judge accepted the same issue that we had for some other team. So yeah, during escalations, it was all okay already. So yeah, we managed to like land two issues that only one other person found. But the other difference is that the sponsor sees the issues immediately. Yeah, and questionable for me because we already had the situation of Haim and ZK Sync. Then yeah, he was there was some kind of connections between Haim and his family member and ZK Sync, something like that,
and his wife,
and like he really found amazing, like huge amount of issues. Like he found like what I saw, like 10 meds, like few highs. He would probably win this contest. And like they found that he had some, you know, like shady connections to it. But what Cantina does, it's like, okay, here's this sponsor, here's our issue. So then, you know, sponsor just can go ahead and you know, just submit the issue, for themselves. And the question is, do we always trust sponsor? Like, should we trust anyone in this decentralized world?
Yeah, but that's a difficult question because you can say, like, yeah, it's Byzantine labyrinth. But effectively, we already trust the judges, to be honest. Because if you're talking about C4 or Cantina, it's also perfectly possible that the judge is participating under an anonymous name, submitting issues, and then approving them themselves. I mean, not saying it's already happened, but it's possible. And there's no way to really know this because, you know, everybody can make an account, get a few K, and then disappear and get deleted. So one point of view, it can happen and in the long run will happen. But if you want to go really strict on that, then you have to fundamentally change everything on many platforms. So I understand the reasoning, and I don't disagree with it, but I don't really see a realistic way because if you say the protocol can't be trusted, well, the judge can't be trusted as well. So if a judge can't be trusted, I mean, for C4, a judge can't participate. Who is stopping anybody? Nobody.
Yeah.
Aside from just trusting the people. So it's difficult. So I understand the concerns.
Yeah, and like on similar note, I remember it was, I think, Sergik that mentioned that first he got up to Senior Watson, but this is the top at the time that he reached that. It was top 10% of people on Sherlock, but he first reached it in his second account, Alter account, that like no one knew him from. And only then he did the same for his Sergik account. So, yeah, like, if it is that easy, you know, yeah, as you said, like, how do you know? How do you know who is on the other side of the computer?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because on that, you just, I think you don't have to really think about it too lot, because it's not a secure system. I mean, in any way, shape, or form, because, like, yeah, mm-hmm. if you think about it, for example, the Maker, Maker issue. If the issue gets validated, the person gets 600k or something absurd. Is there an economic benefit for the dude to go to the judge? Hey, look, nobody knows, but just validate it and you get X amount of money. Is it impossible to happen? Of course not. Mm. Are they going to do it? No, I hope not. I don't think so. But there are so many ways in which these systems can be abused that at a certain point you just have to say, look, let's trust it. And I mean, in a few years, maybe there's going to be something better, but there's no point in putting question marks around everything, because you're never going to stop.
Okay. Okay. Super cool. And if, you know, given what we already know from like different kind of approaches to security contest, if you were to create your own contest platform, you know, and, you know, given the learnings that we have that we just discussed, mm-hmm. How would it look like?
Well, the first question is economic viability. Because it's easy to think of a platform that you have, for example, Trust as the judge, and you have Obrant as the judge. If you're not, for example, the C4 has a tribunal, so if you escalate and you disagree with the judge, then you can call in the tribunal for a price. I mean, I'm not sure if it's in working, but they put it in documentation. With private escalations, and it would work perfectly. But I'm also pretty sure that that wouldn't be economically viable, because if you have to pay a judge of the level of Trust every time, then you don't have any money left for the pot. So it's a very difficult balancing act between making the pot sufficiently large to attract a large number of skilled auditors, while at the same time getting enough money for a proper judge to have proper judgments and validations, so that doesn't have an issue. Now we have like one point, we have Sherlock, where you have an expert, you have good people, but the judging is, well, not exactly fantastic. On the other hand, you have C4, you have good judges, but are there going to be a lot of good people? You don't know. So it's difficult also because of escalations. Because since it is a new and emerging industry, I mean, the rules change a lot. And to say sometimes that a judging is valid or invalid or correct or incorrect is very difficult. For example, I had that finding that the protocol would execute mm-hmm. 4 to 6 external calls. Is that a technically valid issue? Yes, of course. I mean, they're going to fix it, so it's technically valid. Is it sufficient impact to have a medium? I don't know. Most likely not. I mean, if the protocol says, well, we're going to put an AMM on this, we're going to have 100,000 transactions per hour, then yes. Otherwise, no. So the judge has to make this call, and sometimes they say, yes, medium, valid. I would have gotten 100K or something. And very often they say, invalid. And you have... And these are the issues where there's a lot of outrage in the community, because there's one valet was just like just barely valet, and he takes like 50 or 100 or 200K, and everybody's screaming. But is it wrong? Is it right? It's very difficult, because the context is different. And I mean, in theory, you should have, or you could have, like a system in European law, which says if there is a prejudice, then you have to follow that prejudice, or if a judge has previously judged that this finding in this such contest is valid, then the next judge also needs to do this. But that's very difficult because the contest is always unique and the technology is evolving so fast, so that it's very difficult. So, you know, I many times people are critical about judges, but I don't begrudge their work because it's very difficult. And sometimes, regardless what choice you make, you're going to have a lot of criticisms.
I think that Trust said that judge's opinion is his own and he has full right to his opinion about a certain issue. Like, of course, like we will never be 100% accurate with judging, with like finding issues. So yeah, I think that this is the best that we can get, like, because
I mean,
especially on C4, like judges are like elite, like taking from the best people out there. So
well, in general, because I also remember in C4 there was a post about Trust a long time ago about the judges' productivity and judges' evaluation, because that's something that's also could be implemented. But yeah, I think it's just a practical approach. Get the best person you can pay for and trust in his judgment. I don't think there's anything else for the moment. And in time and over time, yeah, more standardized procedures will evolve. And once you have an entire corpus of judgments on specific issues, then it becomes easier. But it's also a very new, I mean, cutting-edge industry, so it's normal that stuff is just like, I don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. So, you know, you just have to live with it, I think.
Yeah, like, the problem is here, like, in normal sports, like, you know who wins. Like, who gets most points and what do you get points for? And here, like, this is very subjective at times. Like, you never know. Like, I think that the Drozes last month was talking just about that, and that, like, most of the issues in contest, like, maybe not most, but he said, I think that many issues on the contest, like, are just trying to convince judge that some BS is true.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because it's also, I mean, one thing is technical validity. Yes, that's pretty clear. But the problem is always impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if for my finding is, has it sufficient impact? To be quite honest, I think in 99% of the cases, no. But there's that 1% chance. So obviously I'm going to submit it, because if it's 1% chance, it's literally a Lambo. So obviously I'm going to do it. And obviously I'm going to try to defend the finding like everybody. And yes, the judge has a difficult work to see, like, what is this? Borderline valid or borderline invalid? Okay, it's valid, but has it impact? Okay, well, that it depends. It depends on so many things that nobody can say with certainty what it is. And yeah, you have everybody is going to try their hardest to convince the judge. And, you know, in the back of the mind, like, everybody's doing it, so, you know, why not me? And if I get lucky, hey, I've got an apartment or a car for me. So
yeah,
of course I'm going to do it.
Yeah, like, concerning BS, like, we already, like, just discussed this. You are very honest about your journey and how much are you earning. Like, this is super cool, because I think that many people are having bad view of, you know, how easy it is to succeed into Web3.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and, like, this is it's interesting, because, like, those people that are, for example, like, achieving in half a year, it's usually not half a year. Like, just experience, programming experience, exploitation experience, and things like that. We already discussed, you know, off camera, some of the issues. Can we, you know, come back to this topic now?
Yeah, of course, of course. Yeah, that's something which I noticed, because I just wanted to journal my journey a bit to build a network and also to get some accountability. So, look, if I post every day how many hours I'm going to work, if I don't do the hours, I'm going to feel ashamed of myself. So that's going to push me to work harder and, at work, in a sense. But I was very surprised that I got so much support when I did that. There were so many people like, oh my god, I'm so happy, this looks real. It's like, okay, compared to what? And when I go to Twitter, it's also, I mean, it's not really malevolent, but people post their successes. They don't post their failures very often because it is embarrassing. You know, I started like my comparison against McDonald's and 4 months later, I still haven't beaten McDonald's. That's embarrassing. You know, I didn't plan on being like, Wojak beat me, fuck. I mean, that's embarrassing to admit, but I was like look, I just want to be honest because the issue is that people post their successes and you see somebody like, there's a really big name, everybody knows him. And he had like a huge victory a bit more than a year ago. And everybody's like, wow, he's awesome, epic, awesome, wow, wow, wow. And I was posting, was like, I was saying, like, look, this is really difficult. I'm frustrated. And he sent me a message like, look, yeah, I understand you. I got this big score. Now, in an entire year, I earned 2,000. And nobody knows that because he isn't posting that. But everybody's saying, like, oh, my God, he got so much. Now he must be a millionaire or a billionaire. I mean, if you can do it once, you can do it five times, right? No. It's sometimes getting lucky, sometimes being unlucky. And there's a lot a giant amount of frustration and resilience required and struggling every day to keep it up. And luck also plays, to be quite honest, certainly in contests, mm-hmm. a big role. Because like we discussed, being valid or invalid can change so much and it's just subjective. I've had findings, like I've had like one specific contest where a submission was deemed valid, where it was around something which protocol had explicitly said, this is not in scope. So it wasn't the scope, I didn't submit it. Somebody else submitted it, protocol said, hey, what do you know? Actually, it is valid. The person who won got like 10K, that opened opportunities for private audits, and he went off to the stars, and I'm sitting there like, fuck me. And of course, it's very frustrating. But I said, like, look, let me just show this in real life. Like, it's a daily struggle, it's a daily effort, and you don't know when success is going to come knocking. You know, every contest, you do your best. Every time you try to get a client, you do your best. But you don't know what's going to happen. And when I see people who are like, look, yes, I'm working 4 hours a day and I'm getting 40K. And like a month later, look how you can make 200K a year. And then, hey, I can make 10K a month. Like, dude, you're losing money or what's going on? Because there are so many people are pretending. And it's also like what a year ago was like a wave of marketeers. It's just like boasting like, look, DM for audits, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And it's like, where are we now? I don't see anything published. I don't see reports. So I just wanted to be honest and show what it's really like. And also, like you said, when we look at like the giant people, for example, Trust. When you look at him, he just came in February of last year. He came in, bam, 70K in 1 month, like four or five contests. And at surface level, you think like, look, he got it, and I don't. I'm just not capable, or he's got something special, or I don't know what. I don't have it. But do I need to go back and look at his CV on his LinkedIn? It's like, look, he did 4 years IT, cybersecurity specialization. Then I think he joined the Israeli army as a cybersecurity expert. He spent like 4 or 5 years, like 50 hours a week, working on app penetration testing, all this. And then when he comes to Web3, after a few months, he wins. Okay, I can get that. Because that's basically 10,000 or 15,000 hours he built up. And then, okay, now he can reach those heights. I, who started, I'm at 400 hours. It's obvious I'm not gonna make it. But that's not something which is clear to many people. And I'm very happy I could share this constantly. Also today, I mean, because basically a bit more than a year ago, I went all in. I'm going to make it in Web3. Well, I didn't make it. I'm back doing it half time, part time. That's not a fun feeling. You know, I went to DSS in July last year. Like, look, this is my new field. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be one of the stars. And now I'm going to Thailand. Like,
no. It's me.
So, yeah, but like, it's me. It didn't work out exactly as it did. But at the same time, you know, failures can also be successes, huh? Because when we talk about it, first, I'm going to give a very real example. So when I was working as a cloud platform security, I was making 15K a month, which is really good salary. A year later, I'm earning 12K a month. And if I had just stayed at my job, I would have had enough money literally to buy a Lambo. So at surface level, you can say, look, this is an absolute failure. I mean, yeah, you could have gotten so much more money. I mean, invested in a meme coin, I would have been millionaire or something. But at the same time, the reason I'm now working as a senior cybersecurity engineer is because I did the year in blockchain. And I'm doing this with a firm. The firm is invoicing me to the end clients. And the end client is paying like 30K a month for me, which I'm only getting half of this because I just started in the industry. But it means that in 1 year, I doubled my market value. Because last year, I was invoiced 15 to clients, 15K. Now I'm invoicing 30K. So that means next year or the year after, if we just forget about blockchain for a second, when I get my direct clients, I can double my income. I can get 300K a year. That's an epic success. So, you know, very often you try something and you fail, but it doesn't mean it's a failure. If you just fail forward, you're still going forward. And I believe it's the same in life. You just have to keep on trucking and, I mean, get hit, fall down, roll over, we get up and go onwards. So, you know, success can come from the strangest places.
Fail forward. I just wrote it down. Literally, I love this.
Yeah.
Fail forward. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's a thing. Like I said, look, I failed a lot of things in my life, but I also said, look, if the goal is 1,000 meters away, I'm 1.82 meters, so I only have to fail 220 times and I reach it. There you go. And, you know, because people are so afraid of failure. It's like, look, I'm going to do this, and if it's not going to work, then I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be the end of life. No. You did your best and you learned some stuff and you failed and you get up and, you know, you shoot for the stars and if you fail, well, you land on the moon. It's not the stars, but I mean, it's outer space, so you're halfway there.
Yeah, totally. You know, like, I think that the biggest enemy of people is uncertainty, because when you are starting, you don't know how much time. Like, if someone told you, okay, you have to spend, like, 2,000 hours and you will find what it is for you at Free Security in order to be that good to reach like top places in several contests. Because I was analyzing like what it takes for the best people, like apart from trust, because he already had like 10 years of experience in top tier cybersecurity companies like and Army, of course. But always, it was this breaking point. Like, the guys were doing 35 to 70 contests, but usually they were breaking point around 30 or 40 audits in that they started to really earn significant money. But, like, no one tells you, like, how much time you have to spend. And I think that this breaks the spirit of many people. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I think you have a great point, because personally also it's the uncertainty. You don't know how much you don't know, and you don't know what is required. And you're just searching in the dark, hoping that by chance you will find the light. It's basically last year in the July and August, everything was going good. I was going forward and all. And that is like 3 or 4 months with basically nothing. Now, if you compare myself, I didn't know what to do. I'm lost. I'm trying to go left 2 steps, then go back, and then right, and then turn around, because I have no clue what I'm supposed to do. But you can get it, for example, the Bulgarians. I mean, it's literally a meme, like the Bulgarian horde is here. But yeah, but it's true. But I know so many people from there, and they have an entire community of people who can show them step by step. Look, no, don't worry. I was where you were, and I did this and this and this, and here we have 5 people who did exactly that. So you can say with some confidence, okay, this is actually possible. And it's not some weird guy in Asia with an IQ of 700 who's doing this. It's people from my village, from my city who are doing this. So I know I can do this. So I think it gives a lot more confidence and faith to go forward. Because otherwise, you don't really know if the success can come. And it changes also. I mean, there's also luck involved. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's so. Don't know. I think you have a great point. It's how more you know, how better you, how longer you can go forward. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially when, like, I saw that you earned exactly $0 for two high severity issues on USSD contest when I was like looking for.
Yes,
it must be demotivating, right? Especially when you are seeing over like young people like doing so great.
Yeah, but that's the variance, you know. Mm-hmm. A very long time ago, I used to be a poker player for a half a year. I did so many things. But a concept in poker is variance. Variance and expected outcome. Mm-hmm. Which basically says if you have, for example, 7-2 offsuit mm-hmm. against aces, which is the worst hand mm-hmm. against the best hand, you have an 82% chance of winning with aces. Yes, mm-hmm. only 82. If you do that 100 times, it's possible you lose 100 times with aces. Because every time it comes, it's like 82%. And in contests, it's the same thing. Because you have a finding, but one, you don't know if it's going to be judged valid. Secondly, you don't know how many duplicates are going to be. And thirdly, you don't know if there's going to be like a unique medium who's going to take the entire pot. So every time you can do good 10 contests with 10 times a valid high, and every time it's going to be a random number you're going to get from mm-hmm. from winnings between 0.1 and 10K or 50K. So it's something I learned after doing like 20 contests. Like I can't really go be outcome dependent. Like I have a finding, I'm going to get paid. No, I have a finding, so I have a chance to get paid. But yeah, it's another level of stress and uncertainty, okay, which people need to accept and learn to work.
Totally on the spot. And your poker experience, does it help you in Web3? Do you feel that it has some impact?
Yeah, it's basically because I can recognize variance when I see it. Because to give a bit more information, so variance, if you play with poker, you usually play 4 to 6 tables at the same time. You have hands, and it's basically under 100,000 hands, which is basically 8 hours a day, 4 tables for an entire month. You can play profitably and have a giant loss, or play shitty and still have a profit, even over such a large sample size. Now, mm-hmm. in auditing, every contest is basically one game, and every finding is one mm-hmm. piece of hands of cards. So if you audit an entire month, you have like 5 cards. So the impact of that variance can have is mm-hmm. gigantic, and it's something you just have to live with. Because one finding, you know, mm-hmm. one finding like USDC is 50 duplicates, I have 0. Another finding, simple documentation, Kanto, it's 4K. Is my finding more difficult to find on Kanto? No, it's just document, just literally not spec. It's the easiest stuff in the world. And I got paid 4,000 times then for an actual bug in another protocol. So there's no real unless you're at the level of trust or Milo, there's often no relationship between the amount of bugs you find and the money you get. It's just random. So, which is also a reason why I think many people want to get into private audits as fast as possible, because there's a lot less randomness there.
Yeah. You know, I recently, what I started doing when I was a bit of free time, because during vacation, like, either me or sorry, we were having vacations and like I had some time on my hat. So I started to do this past contests. Like I scrapped all the contests that are under 1,000 lines of code, and I tried to do them in like 2 days. Yep. And the advantage of that is that you immediately have a feedback. What you missed, maybe what you found additionally, which like may happen because you never know, right? Mm-hmm. But I found it like, if we are talking about what you said, like if you have like 1 month and the contest we are doing it for 1 month, you are only having this much experience. But here, if you are doing one contest in 2 days, you can do them like, let's say 10 over a month. So you have like your volume is 10 times of what you did. Like, of course, bigger code bases, you know, they're a bit different, right? There's way more moving parts. But still, it might be interesting option for people. Did you try to do past contests?
No, not really. But I did do the weighing off between doing a lot of small contests and one big contest. Because the advantage of big contests is you can go really deep. You can go really to the core. But the disadvantage is, like I said, I mean, it takes a lot of time and the feedback cycle is extremely long. The example is Blast. I think it took like 3 or 4 months before there was a feedback. So, I mean, that's basically an eternity in Web3 world. So I spent a lot of time doing a lot of Sherlock contests because those are usually the smallest ones. So I could get immediate feedbacks like what did I do? What did I miss? So forth and so on. So it's definitely good. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when you look at the findings that are the big bucks, those are not the findings you usually find after a day or after 2 days. Those are usually the findings like you spent the entire week or 2 weeks, and just at the last moment you find like the edge case of the edge case, which then gets the big bucks. Mm-hmm. So it's
changing it. Sometimes try to do it as quick as possible, and sometimes go for like 100% coverage. Yeah, that might be an interesting approach.
Yeah, it might be good. I mean, you know. Yeah, but so like different modes of training, and you can do quick repetitions, you can do a long running. I mean,
yeah, like moving on, you mentioned already that you were or are a part of Rock Solid team. So how do you like working with a team? What are the advantages and disadvantages of working with a team?
Well, I really love working in a team because I think you learn a lot faster. If it's a good team, you have like immediate feedback, and more importantly, you have conversations and you can see the perspective of the other person. If you're like two or three people and you find something and somebody else like, look, I don't think this is valid because X and Y, and the other person like, yes, but there's also this and this and this, this and this and this. You learn so much more by exploring the points of view of the other people. So in that sense, it's really good and I really like it and I really love it. The downsides, it's difficult to find or to get together a good team of people who have the same amount of time, mm-hmm. who have the same commitment, who have the same stamina to go forward. Because I've done this multiple times, and very often I see people who are super motivated and they start doing it and go like 10 hours a day, and after a week it's like, oh, I'm exhausted, then I fall sick, and then yeah, I had some stuff to do, and then it just peters out, and it's like who is still awake, please? And then, so it's difficult. I'd love to do contests exclusively in teams, but it's difficult to find people. Because also, for example, now I'm part-time, so if I have somebody who's going to go full-time, is it honest? Is it an equitable, division? Like, you're working 40 hours, I'm working 20 hours. That's not fair. So what am I going to do? I'm going to take 25%? But what is your skill level? What is my skill level? It's difficult to find find people with an exact good match. I think, but yeah, in theory, I think everybody should go and work in teams as much as possible. But with a realistic approach, like this is most likely not going to last forever, which is also not a problem.
And how this approach of doing contests solo and in team differs? Like, how do you play it out as a team?
So as a team, I read a long time ago a post about with Trust and Obrant, how they approached working in a team, and I basically copied this. But like when we're in a team, I basically make per contest a Discord server, make some number of channels like documentations, questions, this and that, and then I encourage everybody, myself as well, of course, to the moment they have an idea or they have something like this scratches, this looks weird. Make a channel. Make a channel with a title and just post a screenshot and a short description. Look, not sure what this is, but this doesn't look quite right. And the point is everybody spams their ideas. Everybody can respond and react and interact. And that way we can go much faster and much deeper. Because if I find something that is kind of sus and I spend an entire day looking at it, and you're my teammate and you're doing exactly the same thing, yeah, that's kind of a waste of time. It's better I put it in like, this looks sus. It looks, okay, yeah, this is sus. We talk about it, exchange 3 points, blah, blah, blah. We come to a conclusion and then we can move forward. So it's basically to encourage as much communication as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because like, yeah, I get this approach. Many people are doing that. And I also heard about this other approach that Spreebit is doing, that they are just opening PR in GitHub. And then when you have PR, you can open conversation on each line of the code. So, yeah, this is also another interesting approach to auditing as a team.
Well, I think it's also, I think doing it like in a Discord server, that helps more with learning, because you're talking to each other, exchanging viewpoints. And I guess with Spearbit, like everybody's an expert there, so... This is more like, look, this is the finding, and then, you know, you have some people who can just have some other perspective, but they have less need of communication to advance, I'm assuming.
Yeah, probably, yes. Yeah. But, yeah, it is not that easy to get into Spearbit anymore, right?
No. It's like what, 2 years ago, it was the gates were opened, and now it's like very, I think they became very picky. Because I think they had the issue that they let too many people in, and then they had like one or two LSRs and then like 50 juniors, and they couldn't really give enough work to the juniors. So I think they're scaling it up. But yeah, for the moment, either you do like a Zix tour and you get like 200K in a year, then you can get in. But it's difficult.
Yeah, or I think that Dead Roses was just, as he said, Zach Obrant. Was referring him to Spearbit.
But yeah, basically you have to be extremely good. I mean, if you're the level, if you're Zichtu or Dead Roses, then you can get in. Yeah, okay.
That's 100% definitely.
I remember like Alex Trent, entrepreneur, he made a post about this. If you want opportunities, just be good. Period.
Nothing else to add.
Yeah. No opportunities. Win a contest, then you get to, can you get opportunities? He isn't wrong.
Yeah, I think that many people, me including, like past me including, now I know that it doesn't make sense. But I also was, you know, looking for this golden rule, this one tip that will change everything. It never happens.
No. Now it was a bit of the same when I started. It was like my goal is to win a competition. When I get that win. When that happens, then I'm going to get opportunities, and then it's going to be forward. And if I can't do that, then I can't do anything else. And then, of course you can win a competitive contest, but that's not really what's important. It's important to become better and just use opportunities. I mean, I think it was like a few months ago, I read I was thinking about private audits, and then I read a report about Hacken, where they had like five documentation issues. Five times, not spec was incorrect. Critical. Like, okay. Like, these people are getting paid for this. they charge like 20 or 40K for this. I can do this in a minute. I mean, I would never do so because I would be too embarrassed. But if that's the level of private audits, I mean, I need to go into private audits just to save people from them. because I mean, if you look at Certic and the absolute. Circus that is happening there. I think there's not really any data about the market, but I think Certic does a giant amount of audits. If I'm not mistaken, why was it one of the big is Binance and the other one of them obliges protocols to have an audit with Certic before they can get onboarded on the platform. It was I can't recall the name, but I think it was one of the two big ones. If Binance and
No way.
I think so, because that's how they do it. Because they have a really good website, I guess, really good salespeople, and they just look. You want to get on our platform, you need to get audited. We have our preferred partner, Certic. And people who don't really know a lot about Web3, they go to the website, and this looks professional. I mean, this looks like Bloomberg Web3.
Yeah, like they have like 1,000 audits on their name. So,
yeah, I mean, if I don't know anything about the industry, I'm also going to be assuming that they're the best. I mean, and they're the most shadiest people that you ever met. I mean, just in a few months, they stole money from Kraken. Then they had Eight Keep just recently. They're starting to do like reports to say like this protocol is safe,
it's not safe.
They had to threaten litigation. Yeah. Like the code is private, but it's still unsafe. So it's posted some threats on this. And then the entire stuff with Shentoo, like they have like a fake bounty platform. So if people submit findings, then they can steal it. I mean, hell. If that's a competition, then everybody should be able to get a place.
Yeah, like I think that we can like talk more about Certic now. It's ideal moment because it happened in exactly in June. So concerning like the Kraken and Certic, it was like they reported vulnerability. However, what they did, they actually stole $3 million.
Yes,
from the contract.
Yeah, it's like. Yeah, we were testing this by actually stealing the money. It's like that's not how this works. That's actually stealing, you know.
Yeah, it took them few days or even more just to like put the money back to the to the Kraken.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most shocking thing is that Certic is able to steal money from Kraken because that's something nobody expected. Mm-hmm. But yeah, most likely it's going to be a few people within Certic who thought, hey, let's have some fun. And then when they did it, it was like, oh, shit, this is not good. And then the entire circus, you know.
You know what? It is not confirmed information. I spoke with someone. I can't recall the exact details, so I don't want to quote me on that. But I heard from people that work in Certic years before, that they have like Certic Asia and Certic Europe. And Certic Asia was the Certic like everyone knows, right? So it was only like automated, like it looked like automated. Like, of course, there were some people, but they were not significant quality. And they were doing insane amount of report. But they also had Certic Europe and the people there were more skilled. I'm not saying that, you know, that in general people in Asia are less skilled because like Luki got at Web3 field, like it seems like quite the opposite apart from Bulgaria, of course. but I mean that, yeah, like the people that were doing this automated or like this really quick, low quality work from Asia in case of Certic, and there was like the additional team that were really skilled. And I'm convinced that right now Certic has at least one super talented guy that is like finding all those bugs. And, you know, if he finds it, he hands it down to another person who, like, for example, steals it from Kraken. And he just moves on to another. I don't get, you know, how. Yeah, but I'm convinced that they have at least one super talented guy that is good, because it's not the first time that they're finding some critical bug in any of the protocols.
Well, there's also the option that skilled auditors submitted the bugs on Shentoo, and then Kraken stole them from them.
Yeah, like another topic. So like. Again, situation with Shentoo was that, for those who don't know, new bounty platform open, Shentoo. I haven't heard about it before this issue, but apparently what it was meant to be, it was Certic in the ship's skin, actually. And they were not really doing these bounties, and the protocols that were listed there, I don't think they were really a part of Shentoo. Like, they didn't know that they were part of Shentoo. And people who put their findings there, actually certain, like, probably, I'm not sure if this was real, but they might actually then report these issues as Certic. So, yeah, the situation is insane.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's exactly in line with our current business operations. And it could also be used simply for business development. If you find an issue in a certain protocol, you go there as Certic, look, we find this protocol, you need an audit, sign a contract, bada boom, a new client. So, yeah. But I think, I mean, that's this stuff which with Certic also, for example, if you look like Haken sometimes, that shows like how much opportunity there is in the market. I mean, if those people with companies with such a low level are able to thrive and find clients, then, I mean, I know a lot of good auditors who are basically doing contests and just wondering what's next. How do I do this? How do I go from here? It was like, I'm not that rosy. I'm not trust. So am I going to be able to do this? Yeah, you're not trust and you're not Audubon, but you're also not Certic. So there's like a giant space between the two. Where I think if they do a bit of business development, there should be like giant opportunities to capture the market.
Yeah.
I mean, especially since it was also a news a few weeks ago that Cyphering is partnering with PwC.
Yeah, like when I heard about it, it was, damn, like no one achieved that.
Yeah, I was. No, because that's based, honestly, the biggest news of the few last months. Because for people who don't know it, PwC is one of the big four, like Deloitte, who are like billion-dollar auditing firms. Because, I mean, in Web2, for every company, you have to do audits every year for accounting, for tax reasons. And those are the most corporate, classic, conservative companies that exist. So if they are going into partnerships with Web3 companies, then that's a strong, very strong indication that they foresee a demand. A demand from the Web2 world, like banks or financial institutions, or I don't know, Coca-Cola was like, look, we're going to go into blockchain. We need audits. We need certifications. We need all the normal stuff. Can you find it for us? They can't, so they partnered up with Cyphron. So that's an extremely positive sign for the development of the market, I believe.
Yeah, totally. 100%. Like, I'm just wondering, what are those big companies? Because like they're planning years ahead. What they do have like in mind? We see, I can't recall, it's Onyx. I'm not sure. This part of one of the biggest banks, JP Morgan, I think. Like JP Morgan has its like Web3 specific federation that they are doing like Web3 research and development. And we see like more and more companies are into Web3. And like we see that whole, the traditional businesses are slowly moving there. And like probably there will be like one single moment, 1 year when they will all, you know, when the Web3 will be really the new .com, that everyone will move into that. And yeah, it's amazing to see, like, especially, like, it was unexpected, like, CodeHawks.
Yeah.
Would you tell that the biggest auditing company would partner with CodeHawks?
Damn it. Yeah, it's our friend that said no. Because you have, for example, BlackRock, who is investing a lot also in different DeFi protocols, specifically in RWAs, real-world assets. Yet, like, there was a contest, Midas, on Sherlock, I believe, a few months ago, which was paid by BlackRock. So, and I also know the BRICS, so Russia, China, they are developing a new payment system, so inter-country currency, which is also based on blockchain technology. So there is a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of the big banks, they are doing this. And, you know, they have their security auditing department, and they are 100% going to say, look, we need to have an audit or a report or a whatever, so that we can say for compliance reasons, it's a go. Because, I mean, that's something I do now for a living a bit. And it's very often that the companies don't really care about the security. It's just like, look, we need to have an audit done so that if everything explodes, you know, my ass is covered. So it's very possible that some of the big banks are going to PwC and do lots. So look, we're developing this. You know, we need to have this certified compliance. So do you have a standard? Do you have X, Y, Z which we can do? Because very often also the development by the big banks isn't exactly the highest quality. I recall, like, what was it? Facebook or PayPal had their coin. Like last year, there was a funny story that they had their stablecoin in 0.4 solidity. If I could recall it.
So. It was PayPal, I think. And
yeah, one of those. One of
yeah,
the,
or
yeah, pay, yeah, PayPal was it, I think. Yeah.
Or was it some kind of stablecoin that
had yeah.
some privileged role. Had to approve each transfer. Are you saying about that?
Yeah, I don't exactly, but it was. I think it was that one, but it was also there were so many basic mistakes mm-hmm. in the code. I mean, that's also a big problem for banks. If you want to develop on a blockchain, where are you going to get developers? I mean, like what? Like 15 in Asia, 2 in Mexico, 1 in Chile, and 1 in Argentina. there's not a big pool, so I think quality is going to be subpar very often, and then they're going to ask audit companies. So I think, I mean, aside from Web 3, like you said, when the moment comes that financial Web 2 is coming to get certified and audited, the market we have today is going to be completely insignificant in comparison.
Yeah, but those will be good times, and those, as you said, who build their ships before the wave comes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I made my calculation. It was mistaken, but I don't regret it because my ship is kind of ready. So if in 3 months, 6 months, the wave is going to come, I'm gonna catch it. So, and even if it doesn't happen, I prefer to try and fail than to not try at all. Because that's a sad life when... you just grow old and you just regret the things you could have done.
And concerning business development, because you were mentioning that, do you have experience in this topic? Yeah. Can you like share some insights to people that would like to know more about that, specifically in Web3 security?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't have business development in Web3. In Web2, yes, because I work in sales in three different companies, one selling cars, the other one selling cybersecurity solutions. There is like two approaches. One is cold calling. One is warm inbound leads. So cold calling is basically you go to a Discord server of a specific protocol. So, hey, do you need a security audit, this and that? Which is possible, but I'm not really sure if that's a good idea. Because especially in Web3, reputation is something very important. And if you're somebody unknown, with all the hacks and malicious things going on, it's going to be difficult. The second one for warm inbound leads, you basically have to produce content. Then we're speaking about articles, we're speaking about videos, we're speaking about tweets or whatever you can make, which people read, which are interested in, which shows expertise and a call to action. For example, I read, what was recently, 33 audits. He's like a marketeer auditor from last year. And he did a number of posts on Uniswap, which did show a certain level of competence and expertise. And now he's getting people interested. It was like, look, Uniswap hook, we're trying to do this. Can you help us? And certainly he's going to get some business from that. So if you want to do business development, it's mainly producing content. Or you need to be somebody known. For example, if you're the devrel of Immunify and you know you literally have a phone book of all the protocols chief developers, that's one way of doing it. But aside from that, producing high quality content and most likely on Twitter, on YouTube, and just produce until the leads come rolling in.
Yeah, and try to be better with each post, each video.
Yeah, it's just a. Yeah, just show expertise and show that you know something really well. So, you know, from articles, I'm also writing articles. I started just from interest because, I like to write about stuff on Web3 and Twitter had their new article functionality. I said, look, this might be nice. And I was surprised with the positive feedback. So something I'm planning to develop more, and do technical posts like ECR20, what was it, what is it, where is it going, common pitfalls of X, Y, Z, interacting with Euler, how to do, how not to do. I mean, you can get an infinite amount of titles, and it's a lot of work, I guess, but that's the best way, I think, to generate interest.
Amazing. And the last question I have for you for today, what would you advise for someone who puts insane amounts of hours into Web3 and they don't have the results that they wish they had?
Well, first thing I would say is it's a marathon, not a sprint. You may be working 10 hours a day. That's great. You're competing against somebody who worked 10,000 hours. So no matter how hard you work in a week, in a month, or even a year, it doesn't mean you will find success. What you need to do, I believe, is make a plan for 3-5 years. Because that's sometimes, and very often in business, how much time it takes before you get to success. So if you say, look, I can, if you say, I need 5,000 hours, roughly speaking, Web3, to get success, okay? If you're a student and you're living at home and you're living in Bulgaria, I don't know, it's easy. Just stay at home, work 12 hours a day for 2 years, and you're going to get there. If you have bills to pay, like many people, and you're working in sometimes in IT, well, then you have to study mornings, evenings, and weekends for many months and sometimes many years, and then you can make a jump. Or what you can also do is slowly move into the direction. For example, if you're in sales, you can go into sales, you can go into IT sales, cybersecurity sales, and then you can make a jump to Web3 business development. That's an opportunity, because there are a lot of technical people here, but not a lot of business development people. And that's a niche which needs to be filled. Same for IT, because, I mean, it's easy to say, yes, I'm going to work weekends, mornings, and every time I can, but it's an enormous amount of work you need to do. Because we see that 99% of the people who have giant success put in thousands of hours in their main job in a related field. That's like Trust doing 5 years of AppSec. That's like Milo doing C-sharp
exploitation.
Binary exploitation 4 years. It's like Sigtur doing 4 years of university education aimed at cybersecurity. He went to a specific school for cybersecurity and blockchain. And then he worked at a top cybersecurity firm. Then the jump is a lot smaller to make. And then the investment of time is manageable. But if you say, look, I'm working at a grocery store, I'm just going to do 5,000 hours plus 4,000 because I don't know anything about IT. You also have to ask yourself, is this realistic? Do I really have the stamina to work for hours and hours and hours without any guarantee that it's going to work? So I would say, depending on your situation, the most important thing is to have a realistic plan. If you're already working in IT, cool. Learn about Solidity and go auditing. If not, move to IT. Move to IT and learn. Except with the exception, if you're a student and you have multiple years free, which is, an exception for most people. So it was just in a few sentences, just expect you have to put in 5,000 hours, make a plan that ensures that you can do it. Because people do often go all in and this has to work. No, make a plan that if a lot of things go wrong, if this doesn't work out, how can I still achieve a success? And the answer very often is double or triple the amount of time in years and calendars required and just start working and don't stop.
And you'll finally get there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... I like Alex Hormozi. He's a big marketing guy and... He basically says, look, it takes 7 years often to achieve greatness in business. And the people who achieve it are those who are still around after 7 years. Most people simply give up. That's the unfortunate reality. And if you just keep on working on it and you have a good idea and you are in the right sector, it's unreasonable to assume you won't have success. Now, it might not be millions and billions, but, success can be a lot of things. So... just keep working and don't give up.
100%. Totally agree. So, Flint, thank you so much. It was such an amazing talk. It was such amazing having you and getting your perspective on this Web3 security field. Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm sure that everyone will love it the same way as people love reading your articles and your tweets and everything. Thanks a lot. Have a nice day and bye.
Yes. You too. Bye-bye.